Charlotte Talks just marked its 22nd year on the air on WFAE. When the show launched, Charlotte was wrestling with growth, the role of race in public schools, transportation. There were big bank mergers, and the country was headed toward a presidential impeachment. The more things change, huh? What hasn't changed is the importance of listeners' financial support. Click the donate button at WFAE.org or call 704-549-9000. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. America has been dealing with race since its very beginnings. Periodically, we take a step forward, usually followed by a few steps back, and each time it is black people who bear the brunt. Recently, the undeniable series of incidents of mistreatment of African Americans by police caught on camera phone video and the death of George Floyd, whose death was also recorded, have led to protests the likes of which this country has never seen. More importantly, this time, white people have awakened to the kind of injustice that stems from this systemic racism and which blacks have known about and dealt with for years. This time, white people are beginning to reject the notion of colorblindness, to actually see race and whiteness, examining the concept of white privilege, and they are beginning to work toward anti-racism and to demand social justice and equal treatment under the law. There are no guarantees that this time will be any different in the end, but for the moment, it looks like a reckoning is underway and people are willing to finally have those uncomfortable conversations that must be had if we are to move forward. Our guests this hour are nationally recognized racial equity trainers whose job it is to get people to talk through the uncomfortableness of these conversations about race. Deena Hayes Green is co-founder and managing director of the Racial Equity Institute. Good morning to you. You got to say good morning. It's radio.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. We don't know you're there if you don't talk. And Susan Plisak is also a co-founder and senior trainer of the Racial Equity Institute. Good morning to you. Welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Good morning. So, Deena, you are an African-American and the former chair of the Guilford County Board of Education. Suzanne is white. How did the two of you come together to start this organization?
Well, I was invited to go to an Undoing Racism workshop that was being facilitated by one of the longest-running anti-racist organizations in the country, the People's Institute for Survival and Beyond, because one of our community organizers, Nettie Code, had done a really good job getting our city officials and other civic leaders in the workshop. And so I was appointed to the Human Relations Commission and was asked to come to a workshop. And I didn't want to go. I'm a black woman. I've served on civil boards of civil rights organizations. I was an African-American studies major. I'm a human relations commissioner. What in the world did I need to go to an Undoing Racism workshop for? But I finally went because she was relentless and Suzanne was my trainer. And I had a little attitude in the workshop. You know, I just, I think modeled or looked like I didn't think I was going to learn anything. And by the second day, I'm in tears and overwhelmed and my life was transformed. So that's where we joined in this work.
Wow. So Suzanne, you were at this business first. You trained Deena. How did that happen? And secondly, how did you work together to understand? I guess you were the trainer. How to facilitate these conversations?
Well, I wasn't really at the business first. I was in this particular mode of delivering the message first, but Deena was working already for racial equity in our community and. Was incredibly far on this journey all by herself and with others before she met me.
And she said that coming into that seminar which you conducted that she didn't want to go to, she had some attitude.
She had a little attitude.
Yeah. So what's that like? Because a conversation is a two-way street in any situation, but when you're talking about racism and you're talking to the people most affected by it. What's it like to be on your side, Suzanne, of the conversation?
Well, I like to make several disclaimers, Mike, even as we begin our training. And one of them is, I do not claim as a white person to be the expert of all time on racism. I do not claim that. I never will claim that. Truth is, you need to question my right to even be there teaching you. You need to question that. And I need to understand that I will never, can never know more than a preschool child of color. But I can know a process. I can know a process. I can know the ways my whiteness impacts it and impacts the world. I can understand my culture. And it is from there I speak and I train and I educate.
Is it easier, Dina, do you think, for a white person like Suzanne to facilitate conversations about race, particularly with other white people? Or is it easier for you to do it because you have intimate knowledge of the impact of racism?
Well, one of our principles at the Racial Equity Institute is we work in multiracial teams. I have an experience and Suzanne has an experience. And, you know, it's really helpful sometimes because of the way that we have internalized our racial identity and how it interacts with the world, our systems and our institutions. Sometimes, you know, there's a saying in the Black community, white people's ice is colder. So sometimes, you know, people of color need to hear Suzanne say this. And it's like, oh, it's true. That really happened. And then sometimes, you know, white people want to, you know, all depending on their level of wokeness or where they're at in their consciousness journey, you know, want to be around people of color. And so we hope we cover all the bases by showing up and bringing our racial experiences, our real racial experience together. We also, one of our other principles is accountability. So Suzanne works in an accountable relationship with people of color, and she always has. She has never been out there doing this work on her own.
So we're having this conversation, and this conversation is being had elsewhere around the country, one presumes, as the result of the extraordinary things that are happening in the country right now with regard to the George Floyd shooting or murder. He wasn't shot. He was killed by a police officer with a knee on his neck. And the ensuing protests that are ongoing, that continue to this day, even though that death occurred several months ago. And what makes this unique, I think, in these protests is that these are young and old, Black and white, rich and poor, veterans, moms. They're all out there protesting for equal treatment under the law. Some people have said that this is an inflection point in our culture. But that would mean that long-lasting change is what will come out of this in the end. Do you think, Dina, that we are at an inflection point?
I do. I do think that there's something about this most recent unrest that says that we're moving forward. I do think that this is the result of decades of organizing. We have these moments in our history, Rosa Parks and, you know, just, you know, these moments, Dr. King and other leaders where their actions have led to change. But that moment, you know, what was behind that were people organizing, people educating, people confronting and challenging these systemic inequities. And so even the use of systemic racism that we have seen in the last 2 months from news analysts and from governors and from police chiefs is the result of that organizing. Not the result of, you know, that this particular incident was isolated and had that impact. You know, people, community and institutional organizers have created an environment under which this moment can be.
One of you used the word woke with regard to white people being woke about racism and the impact of racism. And Suzanne, I'm going to ask you the same question. Do you think we're at an inflection point? And if so, what is it that happened in this incident that broke the floodgates, that opened the floodgates, broke the dam?
I do think we are. I think there's a sea change. So there's more happening. And it is the result of a century of work, if not more. It is the culmination of things. It's not a moment that caused things. The brutality that we saw very up close and personal with Floyd's death has been happening for literally centuries. It's been there. It's been in front of us. We could see it for centuries. So the question is not, did we see it? Did we just now see it? The question is, did we just now understand what we saw? And that is absolutely a result of the organizing that has taken place in this country. The people who have fought and worked and carried water for these issues for so very long, not of a moment.
The New York Times interviewed a guy named Jeremy O. Harris. He's a playwright, and he wrote a play called Slave Play, which I believe before the pandemic was on Broadway, and it was described as being very uncomfortable for a lot of people, it really made you understand what was going on in those times. But he said in that interview, the most frustrating thing about this period is, quote, listening to white people say this is the first time they realize how bad it is. But research shows that one in five Americans, white Americans, report that they rarely or never had an interaction with somebody of the other race. Is that why we are suddenly experiencing this epiphany? I don't know which one of you to ask that question. Dina.
This is a complex issue. I think that, you know, Bryan Stevenson, just world-renowned human rights lawyer, gives us some advice about how to change the world. And one of the things that he advises, he says, we have to change the narrative. So we've had a narrative in this country. We've had a story. We've had an explanation about why we see what we see, why we have an achievement gap, why there are health differences between people based on race. And I think with the massive unrest, the massive, optics, what we saw, so many people that just span the range of identities, as you explained previously. I think it's the converging of all of these things that have made this undeniable.
Having these conversations is never easy, and we've made periodic stabs at it on this program and always promised to come back to it and do, but long intervals transpire in between them. And part of the challenge of having these conversations, I think, is you don't want to hurt people's feelings. You don't want to say the wrong thing. So when you're trying to start a conversation about race, if you're white, do you have it with another white person? Do you have it with an African American? If you're African American, same question. Do you do it with another African American? I'm sure you're tired of talking about it. Or do you do it with a white person? And can you do it successfully and safely if you want to maintain a relationship outside of a facilitated conversation like the ones you create, Suzanne?
Yes, you can have a conversation, but you can't expect safety if you equate safety with comfort. That's not to be expected. Another thing that Bryan Stevenson says, we're really lifting him up this morning, is we need to have a willingness to be uncomfortable. And I always believed that related primarily to our ability to grow, that growth comes when we are not comfortable, when our ideas are challenged, and when we are trying to reconcile that cognitive dissonance. But my son told me, as I was telling him that, he said, Mother, that's not exactly what Bryan Stevenson says. I said, oh, really? You know more than I do, apparently. So tell me what exactly Bryan Stevenson said. And he said, Bryan Stevenson said that discomfort is an act of courage. It is an act of courage. And we must be willing to be uncomfortable if we are going to tackle these issues. There's no way out of that. So have your conversation with the person that presents themselves to have a conversation. If they are talking, our general rule is you talk to them. If there's an opportunity, then in fact you do that. And don't expect comfort.
And of course, the other side of that is to listen, it would seem to me. We'll talk more about that as we go through the program. Suzanne Plisak is with us, co-founder and trainer with the Racial Equity Institute. And the other co-founder, Dina Hayes Green, is also with us. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to the two co-founders of the Racial Equity Institute, Dina Hayes Green and Suzanne Plisak. about how to have a conversation about race, which is something that people are hopefully attempting to do around the country as the Black Lives Matter movement seems to continue on with unabated zeal. In June, Dina, a freelance writer by the name of Trey Johnson, wrote a devastating column in the Washington Post in which he talked about his encounters with police over the years in America, either while riding in his grandfather's car when he was pulled over for an alleged traffic violation as a child, or as a 16-year-old himself driving a car, or as a young adult and someone later on in their 30s and 40s. He described those encounters as usually being frightening, visceral, and personal. And then he writes that white people have been aware of these instances. And when they say that they're aware of these instances, they say that they are appalled. And he said they've been informed pretty much, not through personal experience, but by the media, by podcasts, by movies, and by reading. And he says, so, quote, when things get real, really murderous, really tragic, really violent or aggressive, my white, liberal, educated friends already know what to do. What they do is read. And they talk about their reading. What they do is listen. And they talk about how they listened. So I understand what he's saying, but it seems to put us in a box, white people who don't experience this. So what are we supposed to do?
Yeah, well, you know, I would advise white people to do what we're doing, and that is that we need some more information about this. And it's not just the reading. You know, as we're getting information and working together, practicing having a conversation, taking these concepts and operationalizing them, you know, that's what organizers do. You know, we take the information that we have and that we find other like-minded people. And together, you know, we get in this sort of movement-minded, you know, place where we take issues and we see them in the broader context of a systemic problem. And then we develop ways to begin to confront that problem. I think that the way that we live our lives racially presents certain challenges, particularly for white people, that Suzanne can talk about more. White people as a collective, white people coming together. I had two young girls call me the other day about wanting to make changes in our curriculum. I'm, you know, on the school board, as you said. And the first thing I wanted them to do was to meet Suzanne and some of our other white anti-racist organizers, because I said, you need mentors. This is hard work. It's hard work confronting and working with other white people, your family, your friends, just other people. And it's going to be difficult working with people of color who are very frustrated. And, you know, Suzanne says we hurt who we can reach. And so sometimes even being together with that like-mindedness is very difficult. And so, you know, I think Suzanne can say more about, you know, the role of white people in this work. And, you know, one of the ways that we work together is that until things do change, I don't put all my eggs in Suzanne's basket. You know, I don't wait on Suzanne to change before, you know, I'm figuring out with my collective what it is that we need to do for life to be better and safer for us.
So, Suzanne, I'll throw it in your lap. But what are we supposed to do?
We're supposed to be a part of collectives that are organizing for change. We as individuals are not supposed to step out and lead the charge in any way. We're supposed to organize. We're supposed to build bases of power with people of color whom we follow, and then solidify that base, then enlarge that base, then solidify that base until we have a base of power sufficient to challenge power. That's what we're supposed to do. White people are looking for the me, the I, the individual action. And while there are opportunities every day for you to stand as an individual against injustice, there are opportunities every day for you to do your job or take part in things to end disproportionality and disparity. The work happens organizing in collectives of people led by people of color. That's what must be.
But if white people have the power, and they do, in most situations in America, isn't it incumbent upon us, doesn't it fall on us to push the envelope? Because one of the complaints that's coming out of the George Floyd protests in some cities is that the change that these protesters have asked for, and in fact in some cases were promised by civic leaders and police departments is coming too slowly. And it's been 400 years, so you can understand the frustration and the need for this to happen now and not next year, because it's always next year that it'll happen. So if white people aren't going to push the envelope against these centers of power, who is? And who's going to have more success?
I didn't say we're not going to push the envelope, that we're not going to take part, that we're not going to take action, because all of those things are important. But we have to do it as collectives of people who are organized to do it and who are taking leadership from people of color. We cannot know as white people exactly how things will pan out for another population. We don't understand. We've been racially isolated for 400 years, literally. Literally. And interestingly, most of us never questioned why that was. And we never questioned whether that was all right or not to be so isolated. But we have been. And so now to assume that we know that our actions will be the correct actions, the actions that bring about change, is an enormously arrogant assumption. And we need to not make it. Dina often talks about some of the things that were done by very wealthy people who had literally billions to throw at a problem. And they defined the problem for themselves. You know, to me, it looks like we need, for example, smaller classrooms, and that will solve the problem. And billions of dollars were put into that. And in fact, it did not solve the problem, because they misdiagnosed the problem in the first place. For one thing, they left an analysis of race entirely out of it. And then they used their own understanding, their own life experience, their own education in a white world to form an intervention.
That leads me to a question I had for Dina, and that has to do with something you said about the Racial Equity Institute believes that in order to have these conversations, we must have a shared language. I kind of think that means more than just words. What does that mean, Dina?
Well, the language is put together to form an analysis. And then we use that framework to begin strategizing about, you know, how we begin to do the work that we do together. You know, in our in-person workshops, we used to go around the room and ask everybody two questions. One, how many of you were required to take a semester-long course on race as a requirement for your job? You know, because every system, racial inequity exists in every system, you know, healthcare, education, criminal justice, banking and finance, housing. So no one raises their hand because no one's required to study that. So you wouldn't go to a doctor that hadn't taken a biology course or 10, but anybody can come and talk about race and racism because we've made a complex problem so simple, and we have such a lack of respect for race, which is a primary indicator of your outcomes in life, that we don't even have to study it. And so so we require people to study that, and not in an academic or intellectual way. You know, taking the best of what scholars have put together for us and making meaning of that in effective ways to have a conversation. You know, I looked at a study the other day that said healthy Black children are 3.5 times more likely to die after surgery than healthy white children. And so we see racism in this country through its most urgent feature, which is largely through law enforcement. But Black babies and Black mothers and Black people have been dying at the hands of our healthcare system, as Suzanne said, for centuries. We lose far more people that way. And so this isn't a single system issue, but it's the one that I think is the most provocative. And so we need to come together and figure out how to talk about that so we can put it in its proper context.
I want to come back to some of the statistics that you just brought up in a moment here, but I also want to talk about pushback, because we've been having this conversation on again, off again for a long time. And as I said at the very beginning, that we tend to take a step forward and two steps back. When a big event occurs, we go, oh, we need to fix that, so we'll go a step forward. But no, we want to go back. We'll go back a couple more steps. and that comes from pushback from people who are in power, and white people hold the power in this country. So I've heard, and I'm sure we've all heard, some of the privileged people say, I wasn't alive during Jim Crow. I wasn't alive during slavery. This is not my problem. I'm not racist. I have black friends. I work with black people. This is not my problem. Suzanne, you turn this around. And I think by turning it around, you give people the ability to free themselves of some guilt in this by saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, by saying that you point out that racism is the result of decisions that were made centuries ago. Not by me, not by you, but our ancestors centuries ago. So that takes some of the weight off our shoulders, I would think. But the effects are still felt today. So by distancing people from the causes, the root causes, does that help them see more clearly and be more willing to work toward a fix?
I think it helps them to listen. And we're not absolving anyone from responsibility. I mean, as Faulkner says, the past is not dead. It's not even the past. This lives today. This lives today. It's here with us as powerfully and profoundly, only in new manifestations, as it was 100 years ago. So it's really important that we see that, and that white people see that we have been beneficiaries of that system. But guilt and shame actually don't call us to account, as well as an innate belief in our goodness. If we can believe we as white people are in fact, as all people, sacred beings, then that belief will call us to account over these issues, make us responsible for these issues far better than making people feel guilty and ashamed. Now, is there a place for guilt and shame? It's inevitable. You cannot look at the horrors of these situations and not feel that. What has been done in our name. And we need to see it. We need to face it. We need to look it in the eye. But to live in that guilt and shame won't get us anywhere. It won't move us forward.
A lot of time it seems to me that, and maybe it's because of that guilt and shame, whether it's recognized or not, there are white people who feel aggrieved by people trying to change the paradigm, so to speak. Dina, I did a little reading about you. You spoke at a medical conference about the medical disparities between blacks and whites and the outcomes and shortened life expectancy, et cetera, among black people as opposed to white people. And when you did that, an article appeared in the Triad Conservative in 2019 that took issue with you for placing the blame on racial inequity and accused you of having a long, this is a quote, long distinguished career practicing identity politics and racial aggrievement. How do you start a conversation about this when that is the impression they have of not just you, but other black people who are pushing for change, rightfully so?
Well, the first thing I'll say, if you're not getting pushback, you're not pushing anything. And so, so that's that lets us know that we're doing something. I remember Suzanne talking about Reverend Barber, and Reverend Barber was just talking about all of the pushback he was receiving from his Moral Monday organizing, and saying they're not coming at us because we're weak and ineffective. And so, those are messages to me to keep moving. And I understand. I mean, I understand how challenging this is because we have spent. We have created a narrative. We've created a story in this country around who's valuable and who's a human being. And then we make all of that racially invisible. And now today that your outcomes are on you. And so we have totally ignored that 346 years out of 400 year history of creating a racially constructed society, a whites only society. And then invisibilizing that, taking all of that down, and that's over, and then just seeing the outcomes of that. And so I don't put my energy into confronting people who disagree with this. I put my energy into people who are like-minded and who want to work together on that. I mean, I think healthcare has produced some of the most consistent research, controlling for so many things, controlling for socioeconomic status, controlling for your level of education, controlling for, the neighborhood that you live in and the poverty level of those neighborhoods. And it keeps coming up that it's race, that it's race, that it's race. And so, I don't spend a lot of time with people that are not interested in, at least having the conversation. I think our time is better spent with people who are at least curious about why we see what we see.
Suzanne, you say that society believes that it is bigoted and prejudiced people who are, and their individual actions, who are responsible for racism and the causes of racial problems, but in fact, we have a structure that creates an ideology that causes bigotry and prejudice. Explain that.
Well, we have it backside before of it. We believe that people created the ideology that created the structures that are bigoted and designed in particular ways. But what we know is those structures came first. Those structures were there. We had every system that we have today by the time we ratified the Constitution of the United States, everyone. So that was there before, you know, most people were here in fact in this country. We had every institution save one before we argued Brown. So we must ask ourselves, who created this thing, these things, and for whom? So things were created for us, structures were put in place, it's literally in the DNA. And then the narrative is to ensure that white people not question those things, to ensure that white people think that this will be in my interest and not to organize or question the ways in which they are disadvantaged, we are disadvantaged, or the ways in which we are harming other people. So if you only go with the prejudice reduction and deal with the bigots, I mean, we really could ship them all to the moon and it would be a good idea perhaps, but the achievement gap would still be there. And health disparities would still be there.
Suzanne, I think you're the one that told the New Yorker Radio Hour that we operate in this country from a structure and you're talking about this right now, that promotes the supremacy of white people, which ensures that whatever you do, it's going to disproportionately advantage white people, even when that is not your intent. I have 30 seconds. Can you give me an example of that?
Well, it's Beverly Daniel Tatum and Tema Okun talk about white racism as being analogous to the moving sidewalk at the airport. We don't have to do anything. We're standing on the sidewalk and it's going to move us along. We are going to be the beneficiaries of that system that is the sidewalk. That will just happen. So if we just go about our jobs, raise our children, we will be beneficiaries of that system.
Suzanne Plisak is the co-founder, along with Dina Hayes Green, of the Racial Equity Institute. They facilitate conversations on race, and we will continue our conversation in just a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about race and conversations about race with Dina Hayes Green, the co-founder and managing director of the Racial Equity Institute, and her other co-founder, Suzanne Plisak. Both with us via Zoom here this morning. We've talked many times on this program, Dina, about practices that have kept people down over the years, from redlining to lending practices, urban renewal even in the 1960s, which was described as a good thing, and it turned out to be anything but for a lot of people. Separate but equal schools that were never equal and weren't intended to be. But all of those things are gone now. And yet the effects linger. So given that, how do you get people on that moving sidewalk that Suzanne talked about a moment ago?
One of the things that we've done is spend some time putting together some concepts and putting together information in a way that it's palatable, you know, that people can take something from that. I remember presenting some of our information to a police sergeant in Charlotte, and he said, I'm not buying what you're selling, but the information's undeniable. And so, you know, I know it just, you know, that moment, that cognitive dissonance that we think we're in, is that I have a narrative, I have a story, and I believe that. And I'm seeing things that are undeniable. And those things are pushing towards each other. And so we continue to make things clear. There's this concept we talk about in our workshop called markedness. It's the way that that race in regards to a sort of white racial identity and white racial experience has been unmarked. So Suzanne lives in a historically white neighborhood. I live in a historically black neighborhood. But my neighborhood is the one that's identified as a historically Black neighborhood. We would never call Suzanne's neighborhood a historically white neighborhood. It's been Suzanne's neighborhood that had racially restrictive covenants that said, if you're not white, you can't live here. But it's my neighborhood that's a historically racialized neighborhood. So we mark those things. We talk about the historically white church. We talk about the historically white neighborhood. We talk about the historically white colleges and universities in our country. Because marking those helps people see that they have racial experiences every day. And that when we make that, and Suzanne said, when we make that invisible, then racism thrives.
Well, you bring up, I was going to talk about this with you anyway, because you talk about to dismantle racism, you have to have white people recognize whiteness. White isn't a race to white people. It's the norm. Everybody else is the race and they're different. So that's just because we've had the power for 400-600 years. So how do you tackle that?
Well, one, we make whiteness visible. You know, you can't do something about something you can't see. And so we make whiteness visible. We talk about the construction of whiteness, where it came from. Again, we don't have to study race. And so we can just make it, appear as though it's this, abstract way of identifying people, you know, just for the sake of data collection, not an identity that rules the world, not an identity that decided who's human and who's not, not an identity that shaped every system and institution and then determined what the rules were, what the norms, values, and standards would be for everyone else. And so the making, the invisibilizing of that has created, the problems that we have today. And so our part of our job at the Racial Equity Institute is making what's been invisible visible. Hmm.
So help me out here. On the one hand, white people hold all the strings and hold all the cards, and we take it for granted that it should be that way because we've never discussed it, and it's always been that way. So it's just the way it is. We're beginning to wake up to that not being the case, and maybe some people are working toward changing that. But if you fill out your census form, it will ask you your race. Race is a construct. It is not real. It is something that they made up years and years and years ago, just as whiteness is a concept. So would we be better served, Suzanne, to not fill out that area of the census?
Absolutely not.
Why not?
Race while it's a biological fallacy, it is a political reality. It is a social reality. So to say race is not real, it's not accurate. It's not biologically real or true, but it is real. It is there and it is present and it causes enormous disparity in our country. So if we stop filling out those forms, if we, in fact, do away with those forms, what we have destroyed is not race, but the instrument to measure its effects. So it is important that we fill them out, that everyone fills them out, whether it is the census or whatever else in whatever institution is being required, because that's the only way we can measure what is actually going on, what the outcomes are.
Which makes it difficult, particularly for people who have taken for granted who they are and what they are over the years. It makes it difficult for them to change, and mistakes get made, and I have made this mistake. And as we've gone through the civil rights movement and people have moved through as slowly as possible in many cases, unfortunately, many white people have been proud to say, I'm colorblind. I don't see that. I don't see color. And you're saying that is exactly the wrong thing. That's the wrong approach. Why? Dina.
One, it's impossible. you just can't not see things. If that was the case, you would run red lights. You would just bumble over yourselves all the time. And so I understand that, that's something that we hoped would end some things. And it's also a way that we can get away from confronting what it is that we do see. So we think it's important, especially, with children, telling children that it's some of the research that's been done with young children is that they're aware of differences by the time they're 3 months old. I remember, I think it was 2008, the cover of Newsweek magazine had a picture of a 6-month-old white baby and the caption was, "Is your baby racist?" And so that was pretty provocative. But what they were getting at is that, babies start categorizing, infants start categorizing the world. And when we go around and give them these, these ideas that they can't see what they see, and we really set them up to be confronted with the viciousness and the brutality and the terror of racism and gender inequity and what's happening in the LGBTQ community. And so, one, it's impossible. Two, it's just ineffective. Mm-hmm.
Something else, Suzanne, you've talked about that I think we don't think very much about, but I think that it's probably true, is in our zeal to be inclusive of other people not like ourselves, we often invite people into the group, into the mainstream group. Come on in, be one of us, you're welcome. But you have said that it's usually come, what we really mean is come on in, be like us. Don't bring your ways of being. Don't bring your ways of knowing. Come be like us. Talk about that for a second, because
that's absolutely right. That's been the only invitation. Whether it was to, quote, integrate schools, which of course we never actually did, or to end a disparity in any institution, the invitation is come be like us. Let me tell you how to navigate the system, not change the system to accommodate who you are and how you think and the way you know and your ways of being. And that needs to change. And that means we've got to let go of the centrality of whiteness. We've got to let go that is the norm and all others are simply failures at being us. And that will take a lot of education and a lot of work, but it can be done.
So when you say that we're thinking, come be like us, if somebody comes into the group because we're welcoming them with open arms and they're not like us, they wear different clothing or they have a different way of talking or they listen to different music or whatever it may be, do we usually reject them or marginalize them even though we've welcomed them in? Is that what happens?
Often it does. It's not always in a very overt and obviously unkind way, but it still exists, and it exists profoundly, as evidenced by the fact our institutions haven't changed their hierarchical way of being since their inception. And so cultures that don't live and work in such arrangements have never been welcome, and that change has not occurred. So it might not be an obvious, you know, I don't want to talk to you, or it might be. I mean, we get a great deal. We have a great deal of people who say, particularly Black women, I am told not to wear my hair this way, that this is not professional. I am told not to dress this way, this is not professional. So it's all of those very obvious ways, but deeper and more profoundly, it is in the resistance to actual change inside that institution.
Dina, are, I think, still the chair of the Guilford County School Board. Is that accurate? Dina, are you there? I think we have lost Dina. I think she is frozen.
I see her picture, but have no sound.
Yeah, we have no sound. So I'll come back to that, and we'll try to reestablish a connection with Dina. Somehow we live in this world now where we're not in control anymore. Technology is. Suzanne, in one of the Racial Equity Institute's workbooks, you bring in something called the Four Faces of Racism, adapted from Jonah Olson's Cultural Bridges to Justice program, in which he puts forth the tenets of white privilege. And here are a few. He says, we are handed an invisible knapsack of special provisions and blank checks. To be white in America is not to have to think about it. The expectation that we will be seen as an individual and that what we do never reflects on the white race, that we can choose to avoid the impact of racism without penalty, and that we can live just fine without ever having to deal with racism. When you bring things up and that's just a few of them, when you bring things up in these seminars that you conduct and white people are in the room, what's their reaction to that? Is this a revelation to them?
For some it is. Some are very familiar with it. It's interesting. There are many people who have an awareness, and we are helping them sort what they have seen and make meaning of the things they've seen through their lifetime. And they do very well with that and are actually appreciative. I did the workshop for my mother when she was literally an invalid on her deathbed. She wanted to know what I did. She was in her 80s. And was a teacher and a feminist and a, a, a very outspoken marcher and sitter of her years and of her age. And when I finished, which was a very slow process, many days long, she said, "That certainly explains a lot." And so it simply put into context what she had lived and seen. And I think it does that for lots and lots of people. There's some that will push back. It's very hard to change a worldview in 2 days.
Yeah. There are other things from this Racial Equity Institute workbook and Jonah Olson's Cultural Bridges to Justice program that you use in your seminars. Dina Olson also says that Dina is back. Thank you for coming back. Olson also says that one characteristic of unconscious racial superiority is the idea that my achievements have to do with me, not with my membership in the white group, and that I can feel that I personally earned through work and merit all of my success, and that I have a right to be comfortable, and if I am not, well, then someone else is to blame, and that I am not responsible for what happened before, nor do I have to know anything about it. I have a right to be ignorant, and I see work on racism as the responsibility of people of color, and only in the interests of people of color. Wow. I mean, that's pretty cold. How did he arrive at those descriptions? And when you present them, what's the reaction?
Well, I think that, you know, the myth of meritocracy, again, the narratives, the story we've been told about where people are and why they're where they are. And then people are presented with information that says, did you work hard? Yes. Were you smart? Yes. Did you make sacrifices? Yes. Did you have opportunities because of the color of your skin? Yes. And so we don't take people's hard work and sacrifices and commitments away from them to say, and not but, you also had access to things because of the color of your skin. So we talk about poor white people and working class white people struggling, experiencing enormous hardships, but we're saying that that's not because they're white. We also say that if they're having those hardships and struggles they're suffering, that being white facilitates, is a buffer, is some insulation against that. It's not going to work against you. It's not going to be a liability. And so, so again, we do the both and. We say that, you know, we're not taking anything away. We're also saying that you haven't been denied any opportunity in your life because of the color of your skin.
Racial scholars say that the only way to end racism is for white people to be involved. And you like to point out, Suzanne, that we actually have a dog in this fight, white people, that we are being harmed by racism. How so?
Every day in every way. And it's difficult to see. We talk about it in three very broad categories, and this is more broad stroke than should be. But first of all, it is important to understand that it is spiritually impoverishing to be the dominant culture in a supremacist culture. It is the old, every man's death diminishes me. And there's a human cost to white people, because as we over-focus on people of color and they bear the burden of so much, we don't focus on white children who also are in need as we possibly should. We talk about being in Kentucky and working with Kentucky Child Protective Services when a young white baby died 30 days old, beaten to death. In its 30 days of life, that baby saw four medical professionals and nobody turned those parents in. That's not okay. That's simply not okay. And then finally, the financial cost of this will break this nation, and indeed is. So there's so many things that are in our interest, but they've been kept invisible.
And we have to leave it there, although this conversation can and should go on for a very long time, maybe 400 years, actually. That might help the problem a little bit. Dina Hayes Green and Suzanne Plisak, both co-founders of the Racial Equity Institute. Thank you both for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.